Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why a New York investment firm bought up thousands of acres in La Paz County, including the water underneath it. And when the monsoon storms come and knock down your favorite trees, what should replace them? But first, Attorney General Chris Mays is suing the Arizona Corporation Commission over a controversial move to exempt a major power plant expansion from environmental review. The move comes after the CorpCom voted for that exemption earlier this summer, upending 50 years of precedent in the way the commission has regulated power plants. And they overturned a ruling by the commission's Power Plant and Line Siting Committee to do it. Wayne Shutsky with KJZZ's Politics Desk is covering the story, and he is here now to tell us the latest. Hi there, Wayne.
Good morning.
Okay, so you were on the show earlier this summer to talk about this story that you first broke when the CorpCom kind of voted to do this and give this exemption. Now you're back and the AG is suing over it. Remind us how this all began. Like, this has to do with a 200 megawatt power plant in Mojave County, right?
It's a 200 megawatt expansion of the Black Mountain Generating Station up in Mojave County, owned by UNS Energy, which is a sister of Tucson Electric Power. They're basically expanding this plant up to 200 megawatts, but they divided it into 50 megawatt individual generators. And that's important because the state law basically says if it's over 100, it has to go through this environmental review process.
Okay. How unprecedented is that to take a 200 megawatt expansion and just divide it up so that this environmental review doesn't need to happen in this way?
Well, the first part is not unprecedented. There's a lot of power plants and power companies that do this now. You know, they have these smaller generating units that are all right, interconnected on the similar site. However, this is the first time, as far as I know, that anyone's tried to say that by doing that, this environmental review of plants over 100 megawatts doesn't apply to us. And they point to the letter of the law, which basically says that if the nameplate rating, which is literally a rating on the unit, is under that 100 megawatt threshold, then the law doesn't apply. And because these are technically individual units of 50, they're saying that means we shouldn't have to go through this.
So clean energy groups were not happy about this at the time, as you reported it originally. But now some of them are suing, and they're suing along with the attorney general. What are their arguments? Like, why do they say this shouldn't be allowed?
Well, number one, they say that since this law passed in the 70s, it's never been applied in this way to give to allow essentially what is a 200 megawatt power plant expansion. All of these units are on the same site. They're all interconnected. They use the same facilities, the same infrastructure. So it's never been applied to say that each of these are individual units. So that's basically, they're saying it's nonsensical. You could have a 1,000 megawatt expansion, but as long as you divide it into 11 units under 100 megawatts, then it wouldn't require environmental review.
All right. So how is the CorpCom defending the move then?
They point to the letter of the law, which, as I said before, says if the nameplate rating on a unit is below 100 megawatts, it doesn't need the review. And in this case, it is four individual 50 megawatt units, with each have their own nameplate rating of that 50 megawatt. And so they're basically saying if you want that to be different, that's the job of the legislature. They write the laws. They can go and change this law and clarify it. But our job is to apply the law as written. And this is how it's written.
Let me back up for a second, Wayne, and just talk about what kind of difference an environmental review might make in a case like this, right? Like, what are the real-world implications for the people in the area?
I talked to an attorney with Western Resource Advocates, which is one of the environmental groups that's also suing, and she basically said the environmental review via this line siting committee, the subcommittee of the Corporation Commission, is basically a one-stop shop for local residents who live in the area around this plant to have all of their concerns addressed. They can have agreements approved with the utilities that say, hey, we're going to make sure we take care of X, Y, and Z so it's not impacting you. And it can also include promises for the future. So if that in the future there's light issues or noise issues or what have you, that the utility is kind of on the hook to address those things.
Interesting. Okay, so there are also some questions that some critics have brought up about the CorpCom's new attorney who recommended that they make this decision, right?
Yeah, so CorpCom hired Tom Van Flyn, a former chief of staff to Congressman Paul Gosar, earlier this year to be their top attorney. And this decision relied heavily on an opinion from him, basically saying this is what the law says and this is how it should be applied. That goes against how many previous CorpCom attorneys have have addressed this issue. This own commission, not even different elected folks, but this commission itself kind of required SRP to go through a similar process and go through environmental review with a similar project down in Coolidge recently, but they were getting advice from a different attorney. So Van Flyen is more of a political animal. He doesn't really have a lot of experience in utilities law, as far as I can tell. So that's why this decision is seen as somewhat controversial, because they're getting this radical new opinion on the on how this law should be applied from this attorney who seems like he comes more from the political realm.
Interesting. So these are the kinds of issues that we see brought up at the Corporation Commission, right? And they're often, you know, passed with little scrutiny. There are not a lot of people reporting on this stuff like you are. The commission could look very different after November's election, though. Talk about who's in the running, who, and what that could mean for the kind of important decisions that the Corporation Commission makes.
Yeah. So right now, the Corporation Commission is controlled by Republicans 4-1, for they hold 4 of the 5 seats. But 3 of those seats are up for election right now. 1 Democrat and 2 Republican seats are currently up. And only 1 incumbent, Republican Leah Marcus Peterson, is running for re-election. So as a total, the Democrats are running 3 people for those seats and the Republicans are running 3 people for those seats. So you could really see a shift in balance of power. You could see Republicans consolidate and control all seats. Or you could see Democrats take a majority, depending on how the outcome of this election goes. And this power plant environmental review decision was along party lines. So you could see how, you know, going towards this Democratic slate, which is really focusing on renewable energy and kind of phasing out some of these fossil fuels, could shift how they view not just a vote like this, but votes in the future on the type of energy mix Arizona has in the future.
Very local race. But do we have any sense of how that race might go, or I mean, how it's gone in the past? It has sort of shifted a little bit in the past.
Yeah, it's really hard to tell. I mean, Marcus Peterson has been on the commission for a long time. She's won re-election multiple times. So I think it'd be difficult to unseat her, which would basically cement the Republican majority, because the two existing members who aren't up for re-election are Republicans. But as far as the other 2 seats, it's really hard to say. And not every vote on the commission goes along party lines, I should say. Even with a 4-1 advantage, there's some 3-2 votes where a Republican sides with a Democrat in the minority. And so it's not always cut and clean.
Yeah, it's always a little different at the Corp Con. Okay, that is KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky joining us from our politics desk. Wayne, thank you for your reporting here. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
It wasn't so long ago that all eyes were on ballot drop boxes in Maricopa County, where armed activists were camped out watching voters drop off their ballots. Others were recording voters. It ended up in court with a judge ruling armed monitors must stay at least 250 feet away, and they're barred from filming or following anyone within 75 feet of a drop box. Now, drop boxes are back in the spotlight as November 2024 ticks closer. Conservative activists say they plan to monitor drop boxes this year, but they say it's in order to encourage instead of discourage voting. It all came in a letter from the Conservative Political Action Conference to Attorney General Chris Mayes and Secretary of State Adrian Fontes, both Democrats, that has been met with skepticism, to put it mildly. Mary Jo Pitzel has been covering it all for the Arizona Republic, and she's on the line now to tell us more. Thanks for coming on the show, Mary Jo.
Good morning.
Okay, so I want to start with this letter. CPAC leaders sent this letter a few weeks ago. Tell us exactly what they're asking for here.
They want cooperation with the state's top election officials, in this case, the Secretary of State and the Attorney General, because they enforce election laws. They want them to work together to come up with a plan on how to set up drop box observers, and also to check on people who CPAC suspects might be unqualified to vote and therefore voting illegally. They set out a couple of guidelines on maybe how to do this. Some of them, especially on the drop boxes, fit with the court ruling that you cited earlier, you know, keeping a certain distance, et cetera. But this has not gone over well with the state officials.
Right. So let's talk about that. This wasn't welcomed exactly by Mays and Fontes. You spoke with someone from Fontes's office about this. What did he have to say?
Well, they said, look, you know, we don't think this was done in good faith. And by the way, I should mention that the reason that CPAC is doing this, is proposing this, is that they say they believe if you have an orderly process set up with the cooperation of state officials, that you can try to regain voter trust in elections. They believe people are very distrustful of elections. And I think, you know, we've got a certain strain of that in Arizona and across the country. Mm-hmm. But this would be a way not to harass voters, but to show that things are being monitored carefully and to build confidence. But that argument did not fly at all with Fontes or Mays. And Fontes, the spokesperson, said, you know, this wasn't done in good faith. You know, they learned about the letter from other media. Mm-hmm. They never got the phone call that the letter suggested where they should get together and talk. So it looks like for now, it's sort of radio silence from the state officials. And I'm unclear on what CPAC's going to do going forward. Yeah. But I suspect there'll be some Dropbox monitoring.
Mm. So Mays had sent a statement saying that she is actually open to working with CPAC on this, but she did have some big problems with some of their proposed tactics here. Tell us about this idea of using like open source information or data to try to identify voters at the ballot.
Well, that is the most curious part of this proposal. Like open source data can be manipulated. I can download it and I can change some of the configurations for it. But the question is, how would you determine who's voting illegally? Mm. I don't know, you're going to stop somebody as they're walking up to a drop box and ask them their name? That, you know, I don't know how many people would do that, especially if they knew what the purpose was. Or are they going to be looking through the voter rolls and questioning, you know, people? I don't know how. I've been trying to get answers on that, and I don't have them yet. Mays's, you know, openness to talking is conditioned on an acknowledgement that elections in Arizona have been conducted fairly and freely, and that there isn't the kind of fraud that CPAC alleges has many people skeptical. Hmm. I don't think she's going to get that kind of concession from CPAC.
Yeah. This all also comes at a crucial moment, Mary Jo, like in the debate over what is allowed and what's not allowed around polling centers and drop boxes heading into November's election. A judge just ruled against Secretary of State Fontes in a case involving the Elections Procedures Manual, saying that some of the provisions that were put into that infringe on free speech and they have to do with this kind of thing. Tell us exactly what's at stake there.
Well, that's actually a little unclear, but it's the interpretation of, I guess, how far do you go before something becomes harassment? Mm. And Fontes and the county election officials who wrote this manual say they just want to make sure that voters don't feel intimidated when they go to the polls, and they don't want poll workers to feel threatened in any way, shape, or form. So they put in, you know, a bunch of provisions that a court found just went too far and, you know, and got into the realm of violating First Amendment rights. So we shall see. You know, I mean, the judge did note that if poll workers got a notice that a mob was advancing mm-hmm. on the polling location, that she would surely hope that the election officials would call the police. I mean, she's saying, let's use some common sense here, but we don't want to go so far that, you know, if somebody wants to stand outside and yell at a polling location and they're outside of that 75-foot limit, well, you know, that's America. That's free speech.
Yeah. So Democrats have been concerned about that decision, but also about a GOP plan nationwide that was announced that would recruit 100,000 poll observers around the country. What are their concerns? Like, is it that voter intimidation, like voters will not want to go to the polls?
I guess so. And I'm a little perplexed by that, because election observers come from both parties. I mean, the Democrats recruit them. So right. I think the concern is that, you know, will they behave? Well, you know, again, that's why we have some of these procedures in the Elections Procedures Manual. And I think just generally a call to civility. But yeah, there seems to be some level of worry that these observers, Republican recruited, would not behave well. And I don't know that we have any evidence that that would happen.
All right. Interesting stuff. Mary Jo Pitzel with the Arizona Republic joining us with more on this story this morning. Mary Jo, thank you for coming on. Appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, happy to share. Thanks.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, in most parts of the country, fall smells like pumpkin, apple, and cinnamon. But in the Southwest, the end of summer brings another distinct scent. roasted Hatch chilies. One cookbook author has tips on making the most of the season. But first, a New York-based investment company earlier this summer bought nearly 13,000 acres of land in La Paz County. And some critics worry the $100 million deal will mean less water for residents of the western Arizona county. Water Asset Management describes itself on its website as a, quote, global investor in companies and assets that ensure water quality and supply. It's also bought land in other western states. As the Arizona Daily Star reported, the land in La Paz County is in a basin that by law is approved for groundwater transfers. That means the water could end up in more urban parts of the state. Some residents of La Paz County are already concerned about other firms using local groundwater to grow crops shipped to other countries. One of those people who's concerned is County Supervisor Holly Irwin. She talked about it with my co-host Mark Brody, and they started with why this deal is such a problem to her.
You know, water, as you are well aware, has become a major issue. I've been dealing with water issues in La Paz County since 2015, when it first got put on my radar. And so, you know, the ultimate threat is being targeted as a sacrificial lamb, you know, to supplement the urban areas within the state. And so it's been a growing concern of mine, not if, but when they try to come after, you know, the waters that are in the groundwater that's in our basins, as well as the surface water on the Colorado River, which we're seeing both.
So my understanding is that this particular land, and specifically the water underneath it, is approved under state law for groundwater transfers. So, like, is it surprising that something like this would have happened in this particular place?
You know what? I didn't learn about that particular part of the basin till a few years back, you know, when it was mentioned as I started doing research on groundwater and the basins within La Paz County. And, you know, then, of course, in dealing with our representatives, they were like, you know that these are in statute. And I was literally floored. You know, I couldn't believe that, you know, we actually have three transfer basins within our county, you know, for water transfers. So it almost makes it impossible to try to fight for protection when the leaders previous to me at the state level had put in, you know, statutes for to allow for these transfers to take place.
Has there been any effort, or do you anticipate there being an effort to try to undo that, to make it so that, you know, these are not available for transferring water to more urban areas of the state?
I will do whatever it takes in my power to try to fight these transfers, or, you know, anything I can do to fight to keep the water within La Paz County. You know, being a representative for our county and for the people, you know, that I do represent, my constituents, you know, I have a duty to try to fight for them to keep the water here and protect our future and theirs as well.
How big of an impact could this water leaving La Paz County have on the people who live there, the farmers who live there?
You know, it's going to have a major impact because, you know, we're already seeing issues within that basin. You know, already have constituents that have lost their wells. Some have had to replace their wells twice now. You know, so you add this on into the mix and it's just going to make the problem worse.
As you say, you've been looking at this and working on this issue for some time, and I know you and I have spoken in the past about some of what you're seeing and what you're hearing from your constituents, from your neighbors about their particular situations. What have you been hearing recently in terms of, you know, wells potentially running dry or subsidence on particular pieces of land?
So there's two things there. So land subsidence definitely is an issue. Since I've been in office since 2009, I've literally experienced damages from 100-year floods out in these areas in the Windon and Siloam area, and land subsidence definitely has played a part in the amount of damage that we are receiving because of the land, you know, dropping. So that's became a major issue, and you know, I had been contacted just as recently as 2 weeks ago to an air park that had lost their well out in the Siloam area. You know, and that was just 2 weeks ago. And this is stuff that comes up all the time, you know, where you're hearing somebody that had to replace their well. There's another RV park out in Windon area where they had to replace their well, I believe less than a year ago, you know, and that cost them well over $100,000 to replace theirs. You know, these are just you know, it's it unfortunately it's almost became the norm, you know, which is unfortunate because it shouldn't be that way.
Is there anything that you can do short of changing state law to try to keep some of this water in La Paz County?
Well, that, and I've been working along with other supervisors as well as previous representatives, you know, trying to form more of a local control type of a management area because we're the ones that are dealing with the issues every week, it seems like. And you know, we've been trying to fight to get some sort of protection, an alternative to the AMAs and the INAs, you know, but it's very difficult to try to do that when you can't even get a hearing on a bill down at the Capitol. So it's been extremely frustrating.
Does it matter to you if the water that is leaving La Paz County is going to a place like Phoenix, or if it's being used, for example, to grow alfalfa to send to another country? Like, does it matter to you what the use of that water is if it's not being used by La Paz County residents?
It should be being used by La Paz County residents and the county as well, period. You know, we shouldn't be a county that's just a sacrificial lamb for another.
What do you hear from your constituents about the fact that, in this case, you know, a group has come in and bought all this land to move the water to urban areas of the state, or, you know, some of the other water-related issues that have been going on there over the past few years?
For right now, there, because this just came up recently, I think there's a lot of, oh my gosh, you know, a lot of shock going on right now that how could this possibly happen, you know, but who are we to say who's to sell their land to? You know, we don't have a right to do that either. The only thing I can try to do is protect the water that we have within our basin. And, you know, again, that's been the biggest challenge that I've faced my whole entire career. We're just a little county. You know, we only have three supervisors that are in our county. But it's definitely a bigger issue, not just here in La Paz County, but in my sister counties as well, you know, there are neighboring ones. And it's not just Arizona. We, you know, you need to take a look at the bigger picture and who these investors are. They're grabbing up land all over the western portion of this country. We don't have the money to be able to purchase that land. You know, that land was sold for $100 million cash.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
Obviously, you know, come January, there will be a new batch, at least to some extent, of state legislators. Are you preparing to try to have some bills ready to go to try to address these situations come the new year?
Yes, and you know, and I must say that I'm still working with my colleagues as well. You know, I'm working with supervisors out of Yuma, out of Mojave County, out of Yavapai, Cochise. You know, we're all collectively concerned about the same issue, and that is protecting our groundwater. So we're still working. There's still communications going on with the governor's office, with different legislatures that are still currently there. And those that will continue to be there in the next session. So, you know, there has been more communication, I think, in the last 2 years and more movement on water, than there has been since this has became an issue for me, in La Paz County. So that gives me some sort of hope.
All right. That is La Paz County Supervisor Holly Irwin. Supervisor Irwin, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. It is monsoon season here in Arizona when we see the clouds building on the horizon in the afternoons and watch the storms roll in at night. At least we hope that'll happen. So far this year, the valley hasn't seen a lot of rain, but when those storms come, there's also storm damage. Trees downed, branches on the ground, sometimes flash floods or worse. But when we lose trees to the monsoons, what should they be replaced with? And what trees can survive the storms best? For more on that, I sat down with our resident tree expert, the City of Tempe's urban forester, Richard Adkins. And we began with some of the biggest trees in the valley, the eucalyptus. You certainly see a lot of them losing branches when the storms hit, and a lot of people assume the non-native trees are bad for the valley, but Atkin says they're not.
I don't think they're bad at all. There are some large, older eucalyptus that are growing throughout the valley, and yeah, a lot of those branches do break and they will fall in the monsoon storms, but you know, a lot of those are just very old, and some of the newer species that we're planting, They don't have that problem.
I've heard they have been referred to in the past as widow makers because of those branches falling.
Yeah, the large branches, they get stuck up in the tree sometimes, mm-hmm. and then they'll shift as people are walking under and unsuspecting, and thus widow maker.
Okay, so tell us about the history here of these, because there are not a lot of like 100-foot tall trees in the valley, but eucalyptus are certainly some of them, and you see them all over the place, but they're not local, right? They're an Australian tree. How did they end up here?
They are Australian tree. There's actually over 700 species of eucalyptus, and they all are from the Australian, Tasmania, and the islands that surround that continent there.
Hmm.
They first came to California in like the mid-late 1800s when they were planted there, and they started moving across the United States. The first recorded ones that we know here in Arizona were in the 1920s at the Boyce Thompson Arboretum out in Superior.
Hmm.
They were planted for windbreaks, and people thought they were going to be good timber. And they ended up not having very good timber qualities. So basically the essential oils, firewood, and fuel firebreaks.
So they do well in the desert. I can see that. Lots of Australia is desert, right? That makes sense. Why do they do so well here?
They do well here because they're very drought tolerant and they can really deal with the heat that we have.
Mm-hmm. And not a lot of trees can do that, right? So let's talk about trees that do well or not so well when it comes around this time of year and we start to get these monsoon storms. We've gotten a few here in the valley, a lot down in Tucson this time of year. When the winds come, you get those microbursts, you get these very super specified monsoon storms. Is a eucalyptus tree a good tree to have near your house?
Now, it would depend on the species, and I guess it would depend on your property. I mean, it always goes back to you got to have the right tree for the right space,
mm-hmm.
depending on the benefits that you're really looking for that tree and the site conditions that you have. Now, if you have a small patio home, one of the larger eucalyptus, camdolensis, in the backyard is probably not your choice of tree. But one of the smaller, like the bookleaf molly, gets up to about 25 feet. It's a very beautiful tree. Be fantastic for that. No problem with the storms.
That's a great title, by the way, the bookleaf molly. What other trees do well in the monsoon season, or maybe not so well?
Well, within the monsoon season, you got to be very specific because, again, it depends on the site. So there's a number of trees that we want to look at that are climate adapted here in the valley. So a lot of our elms will do well. Some of the acacia species do quite well, fruitless olive, tipu, just a few trees that actually do quite well here. They're very nice big shade trees.
Yeah. Are there parts of the monsoon season that are good for trees, right, that will help them out, make them stronger, and maybe benefit from those deluges that we'll get here and there?
Whenever we do get that deluge. We haven't had much rain so far up here in the valley, but that good rain is always helpful. But a little bit of wind, trees have a natural dampening effect with the way that they're structured, so they can generally handle a good windstorm. It's the way that we maintain and prune them sometimes that really throws off that balance, and the tree can't handle it, and the wind comes and grabs the branches, and it actually ends up breaking them off.
So we need to trim them up. How do you do that well? Does it depend on the tree, too?
Actually, I would say we might need not to trim them up so much, because people tend to over-thin them. You always hear, well, we need to thin the tree so the wind can blow through. No, the tree wants to work with the wind. And like I said, it's a dynamic dampening process. So, I mean, you want to get them up so they're not in your face or hitting your building or your home, but you want to be sure not to over-thin them too much during the monsoons because the wind can just grab those long branches that are hanging out there with, you know, tufts of growth at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like a lever arm is how it works, and it just snaps those branches off.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what this all means for, you know, what trees do well here, not just in the monsoon season, but beyond that. Because every year in the monsoons, we're gonna lose some trees, especially older ones, some of the really big ones, right, which you want to be careful of. As you're replanting, how do you choose what to replant?
Well, it kind of depends. I'm going to work with the property owner. And if it's worth a city, I'm going to work with your municipality. If I'm coming over to your home, I'm going to work with you to see what the benefits and values you're looking for in a tree. Are you looking for something that flowers? Or are you just looking for shade? You're looking for something that's going to provide you some food products.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm going to see what you're looking for in your benefits and value needs and then look at your site. And then I'm going to try to site the right tree for you.
How do you approach that on a sort of a mass scale, like in the city of Tempe, for example?
Well, I'm looking for diversity, for one, because we want not just a monoculture of species. We want different species to work with, as well as different age classes of species, so that we have a continual sustainable forest.
Are the kinds of trees that live and survive well here changing as climate change takes hold and things get hotter and hotter?
I think that's something that we need to expect. The trees that we were planting in the 60s and the 70s, we're no longer going to be planting those coming up in the 30s and the 40s.
Hmm.
I mean, we always like the native trees, and everybody likes the native mesquites and ironwoods and Palo Verdes, desert willows, fine stock, but they're not for every location. So, you know, I try to work with the native palette first, and then there's, you know, some other introduced species that do quite well here that are drought tolerant, low water use, can maintain up into the storms and not break in the winds and still provide benefit and value for the community.
We had you on the show last year to talk about the Aleppo pines, these beautiful big old trees that are starting to really die off here, largely because of the heat, but partially because of age and, you know, being attacked by insects when they're weak, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, right? And you said at the time that you thought that the tree cover in the valley, and you're very involved in creating this in Tempe, right, would look different in the future as shade becomes more important, but as the city becomes more extreme. What do you think it will look like?
This is my opinion from just working here in the valley for over 25 years. We're going to go to smaller stature trees, back to what the native desert structure looks like. I mean, if you go out into the Sonoran Desert, you'll see your ironwoods, your mesquites, your Palo Verdes. They're very low to the ground, full canopies going all the way down. And, you know, we plant them here in the urban space and we lift them all up and we want them to be tall and provide us shade. So I think we're going to have a restructure of that and go back to smaller statured species. The taller pines and eucalyptus like you see now are probably going to be a thing of the past.
So is that like a loss in some ways? You can still get shade out of these, but it'll feel different, right?
It's going to feel different. It's going to look a little bit different. We have to be more intentional on our siting of where we're putting the trees, not just, well, we're going to plant a tree here and plant one there and everybody's going to have shade. Now, we have to really look at our resources and the way that the cities and municipalities are developing mm-hmm. with the urban form, and it's really going to drive the decisions that we need to make.
How important is shade going to be in our city's future?
I think for livability here, as well as for just human health,
yeah.
Extremely.
All right. Richard Adkins, consulting arborist and Tempe urban forester, joining us. Richard, thank you for coming in. I really appreciate your expertise here.
Thank you for the conversation.
In his new book, Tablets Shattered, journalist Joshua Leifer sees American Judaism in transition. For decades, Leifer writes, much of American Jewish life was characterized by a pervasive sense that America was the center of Jewish culture. It was a place that had provided safe harbor for Jewish immigrants fleeing poverty and genocide, and a steadfast supporter of Israel. But towards the middle of the 20th century, Leifer argues, many American Jews faced a kind of identity crisis. Having worked so hard to assimilate into mainstream American life, they suddenly felt less dependent on Jewish identity to define themselves. And then came the Six-Day War of 1967 and the Yom Kippur War of 1973, from which Israel emerged, having claimed vast swaths of territory in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. As Leifer recently told the show's Sam Dingman, these conflicts prompted a radical reinvention of American Jewish identity that continues to this day.
Israel basically offered a kind of identity life raft in a lot of ways for American Jews who were searching for something more.
Right. There's a quote in the book, I think it's from Herman Wouk, where he says, the threat of Jewish oblivion has become, quote, the threat of pleasantly vanishing down a broad highway at the wheel of a high-powered station wagon with the golf clubs in the back.
It's a great quote. It's very angst of suburbanization. I mean, there was also, of course, the pride of seeing Jews be strong after the Holocaust, which is, I think, something that often gets lost when people think about the wars in 1967 and 1973, which is that the reaction that Jews have is related to this moment in time when what we now call the Holocaust, the events of the Holocaust, are being metabolized by a lot of Jews.
Right. One of the ways that you put this in the book, and this is actually very early, is you talk about this kind of dawning new sense of Israel-centric Jewish identity as, quote, the bellicose nationalism of people who, bound together by the trauma of the Holocaust, having only understood themselves as history's ultimate victims, could not recognize that they now possessed power. And the thing I really love about that description is that, you know, I realize we're skipping a few years here, but this somewhat sets the stage, right, for a period between 2008 and 2014 that you argue in the book is the backdrop for the moment that we're seeing right now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in 2008, Israel wages what was then one of the most destructive wars it had waged against the Palestinians, what Israel calls Operation Cast Lead. There's a very short military operation called Pillar of Cloud in 2012. And then in 2014, there's Protective Edge, which is also one of the most destructive wars. And in each of these, a generation of American Jews is exposed to an Israel that is very, very different from the Israel that their parents knew. Instead of an Israel that seems vulnerable compared to its adversaries, this is an Israel that seems massively more powerful than the Palestinians.
Yeah. And one of the things that you highlight in this section of the book is the extreme difference just in raw casualty count in these conflicts. In Cast Lead, 1,385 Palestinians die as opposed to 13 Israelis. In Pillar of Cloud, 167 Palestinians die versus 2 Israeli soldiers and 4 Israeli civilians. And then in 2014, 2,104 Palestinians killed as opposed to 66 Israeli soldiers and 6 civilians. And as you frame it in the book, these raw numbers seem to be a kind of real awakening for primarily younger Jewish Americans to this different consciousness about what Israel is and what it represents.
Exactly. October 7th alone was the deadliest day in the history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And one of the things, just thinking out loud with you here, that will remain to be seen, actually, is whether this will lead to a new sort of paradigm.
Yeah. But as you point out in the book, beyond the concerns on a human rights level and on a political level that many people have about this conflict, there is this really important cultural backdrop, which, again, to quote you, you frame very memorably as what is left of American Jewish culture appears to have lost its distinctiveness and its bite, devolved into mere kitsch and cliche, no more Saul Bellow novels, only Seth Rogen movies.
I mean, I think the erosion of alternatives, of alternative forms of Jewish identity and expression is totally central to why the crisis over Israel is so deeply felt, because we have this historical process by which Israel becomes the core of American Jewish identity. But then the question is, well, what happens if Israel isn't something that people can positively identify with? What's left? Jewish secularism doesn't have the dynamism that it has when it's the Saul Bellow novel, which is Saul Bellow becoming an American.
Well, and there's a particularly interesting concrete backdrop to all of that that you talk about in the book, which is, you say, again quoting you, in raw numerical terms, the eclipse of American Jewry by its Israeli counterpart marked the end of the American Jewish century. And what you're talking about is the fact that by 2050, most of the Jews in the world will live in Israel. And if I'm not mistaken, there are already more Jews in Israel than there are in America. And that's a very profound change for a number of reasons. But one of the big ones that you talk about is that it makes it harder to hold on to this identity that Jews had for so many generations as a diasporic people, a people characterized by having no true home.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think what I mean by the American Jewish century in Tablet Shattered is that the 20th century was the period of Jewish history when American Jewry was the strongest diaspora and was arguably the center of global Jewish life. And American Jews understood their relationship to other Jews as being at the center of this relationship. And one of the things that's changed is that that's no longer true. And there's this other population center of Jews that's bigger and becoming bigger. And part of also what adds to the weight of thinking about how does Israel fit into American Jewish identity is that Israel is setting the terms of America, of Jewish identity, period, in the world.
Well, I wonder, Josh, perhaps in closing then, if I could ask you to read a passage that comes towards the end of the book that I think speaks to what you were just saying. It's on page 217.
Yeah. I will not renounce my belonging to our collectivity, nor will I adopt a pose of radical hard-heartedness toward the fate of Israeli Jews, as some on the American left have done. I do not chant, not in my name, but prefer to accept that because Israel is increasingly home to most of the world's Jews, I am, as a Jew, implicated in its crimes. I want to speak to my fellow Jews, to beseech them, if necessary, even to force them through sanctions or conditions imposed on future U.S. support, to pursue justice and seek peace instead of occupation and endless war. Our fates are inextricably entangled. So it is my obligation.
Well, Joshua Leifer, author of Tablets Shattered, The End of an American Jewish Century and the Future of Jewish Life, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. In many parts of the country, the first real signs of fall have to do with leaves changing when there's a chill in the air and the days get shorter. But here in the Southwest, fall has its own flavor. When you start to see hatch chilies on the shelves at the grocery store, or if you're really lucky, when you smell them roasting outside of the supermarket in those big rotating roasters. And while these iconic peppers are only grown in Hatch, New Mexico, the season has really become a hallmark of this transitional time of year throughout the Southwest. I spoke more about it with Tucson-based cookbook author and food photographer Jackie Elpers.
I remember when I first moved to Tucson 30 plus years ago, I was amazed that in the late summer and early fall, they would have these Hatch chili roasters outside of the grocery stores. I'd never seen anything like that before. Yeah. So they'd have these big metal roasting containers would spin and you could smell the chilies roasting as you walked up to the store. And I remember thinking that was so special. But even now, I'm amazed at how much it has evolved to becoming just something that everybody really anticipates. Every grocery store is like really celebrating it to the point of like, Fry's had me write a recipe and they're having recipe cards in the stores.
Oh,
and all
wow.
kinds of like special, like little things. Like they've really latched onto the whole Hatch chili excitement. Everyone now kind of gets that it's Hatch chili season.
It's like a sign of fall in Arizona,
it
right?
It is.
That's an exciting thing after a long and hot summer.
for sure. It's a little bit earlier than like, you know, than the Halloween or pumpkins and all that. So it really is a wonderful kind of transitional moment.
I love that. Okay. So let's talk about the flavor profile of a Hatch chili because it really is distinct. It does not taste like any other kind of chili, maybe closest to a poblano or an Anaheim. How would you describe it?
I think it's probably closer to an Anaheim. Of course, the Anaheim chilies are coming out of Anaheim, California for the most part. And the Hatch chilies are coming out of Hatch, New Mexico. And so there's a difference kind of based on terroir, just like a wine. The Hatch chilies, they have more of an earthiness. They're a little bit more complex in flavor. They don't taste as, I would say, Anaheim chilies taste green. You know what I mean? They have that kind of green, raw flavor. Whereas the Hatch, of course, they also taste green, even when they're kind of starting to turn orange and red. But the flavor is much more complicated. It definitely almost feels more from the earth, if that makes sense.
It does. How spicy are they? Because it seems to be different every time I try one.
Oh my goodness. They can range in spice from very mild to very, very hot.
Okay.
And in fact, I visited a chili roaster at the farmer's market this week to see what he had in stock because they're roasting chilies right now at the farmer's markets as well as supermarkets. Mm. And he said that he only had the super hot chilies left. Everything else was sold out. And he showed me that you can tell the difference between the super hot, that they're kind of thinner and they've got like a pointier tip. Huh. So he gave me a couple to take home because I usually go for medium. And I will tell you, they are incredibly hot.
So let's talk some recipes here, some ideas. I think there are some obvious things where you're going to see Hatch chilies used every year, you know, and enchiladas, maybe in a stew or something like that. What are some of the Hatch chili recipes that are your go-tos and that are maybe, you know, a little bit offbeat?
Well, I don't know if it's offbeat for Arizona, but I really love machaca and eggs. Mm. I'll take machaca, which is the dried shredded beef that you can get at a lot of the meat markets around town. It's already come shredded, and all you have to do is pan fry it with the diced Hatch chilies, which you can either roast in advance or just use as is, and onions and tomatoes, and then mix that all in with scrambled eggs, and it is fantastic.
That sounds amazing. Favorite breakfast. Absolutely. What a good breakfast. And using them in a breakfast is a cool idea, yeah. So let's move through the meals then. What about when it comes to lunch dinner recipes? Where do you like to use Hatch chilies? Where have you seen them lately?
Well, I see them all the time on cheese crisps, which is a really common Arizona kind of staple. I've been making caldo de queso. I'm feeling kind of fall right now with the big chunks of potatoes and green chilies, kind of a clear broth. Of course, there's always chili verde, which is either pork or beef cubes in a green chili stew, which is very popular around here. It's served in tortillas or in tacos or burritos. Oh, also, I've been really enjoying green corn tamale pie.
Mm.
It's kind of like all the stuff from inside of a green corn tamale put into a pie shell and then baked, and then I'll do a mole on top. So it's a nice kind of almost like a rich, creamy, kind of the consistency of like a bread pudding, I guess. Mm. And then with the mole on top, it becomes this fantastic kind of vegetarian meal with a, you know, mole is not really that sweet, but there's always that like kind of chocolatey, chili kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Which is a fun one.
Well, you're making me hungry. Jackie, can you use a Hatch chili in a dessert? Is this something you've ever done?
Well, I haven't, but I should, because as soon as you started talking about Hatch green chilies and desserts, I started thinking, oh, what about like Hatch green chili ice cream, you know, where there's that creaminess and maybe even has like, you could even use corn and ice cream. I make a corn paletas, which are the popsicles, and then you could dip them or add a little bit of green chili powder in with that.
Mm.
And in fact, that reminds me that a really great thing that you can do with an abundance of green chilies is turn them into chili powder.
Right.
And then you can make your own spice blends. Like you'd mix that green chili powder with salt, and then you've got a chili salt, or any kind of chili blends. You could do all kinds of great stuff.
That brings me to the question about storing, right? Because if you have a lot and it only comes around once a year, what do you do with them? How do you keep them?
Yeah, there's a variety of things that you can do. As I said, the drying, which is really easy. All you have to do is slice them into rings and then dehydrate them in a food dehydrator.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could either store them like that, or you could grind them into a powder using a coffee grinder. Mm. When that's specifically for that, because you don't want to have... Well, I mean, that actually might be good, but...
Green chili coffee is not the worst idea I've ever heard.
Yeah, it might be awesome. You can also roast them in advance and then freeze them. And so, you know, in batches, just like you would an abundance of any other kind of fresh vegetable.
Can you pickle them?
Oh yes. You can pickle them. You can do the quick pickles just like you would jalapenos. You know, it's very easy to quickly pickle something, or you could do like the more traditional canning method where you heat up the bottle and make sure everything is sterilized appropriately so that it will keep for a long time. Mm-hmm. But that's a great idea.
All right. We will leave it there. That is Jackie Alpers, a cookbook author and food photographer based in Tucson, joining us to talk about Hatch chili season. Jackie, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, that'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. Be sure to join us again tomorrow morning with much more, as always. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. If you heard a song you liked on today's show, you can follow us on Spotify as well. Just search KJZZ's The Show on the app, and you will find our monthly playlist. For Mark Brody, I am Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.